This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us now is the moderator of Face the Nation and CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Brennan. Margaret, the Attorney General seemed bothered by the reaction to the Mar-a-Lago search, and so now he's going to release the warrant. So what can we expect to see in this?
Well, now that the former president has agreed that he, too, wants the underlying information revealed, we can expect that the warrant will be disclosed. Now, exactly what is redacted from there, how detailed it will be is unclear, but we know the attorney general made this incredible public statement and call for it to be released because of the extreme public interest and also the politicization of it. You know, we've seen a spike in rhetoric and threats against law enforcement online after the FBI carried out this search of the former president's Florida property earlier this week. And so unveiling the facts of the matter may help to dissipate some of that at least politicization or outcry about it. So we will stand by. We don't know when we will get that. And we also don't know if and when we will ever understand more about the underlying affidavit. In order for a search warrant to have been obtained and executed, the FBI has to have an affidavit that sets forth probable cause. When will we learn exactly what that probable cause was here in terms of suspicion that a crime was committed?
But he also seemed to feel the need to give, a morale boost to the FBI because of all the public criticism. He seemed to be worried that, essentially, yeah, respect for law and order was dissipating.
Well, there is a lot of concern in preceding this just about the level of tension and divide in this country. Yesterday, you had the ADL, the Defamation League, come out talking about the level of hate they are seeing that has spiked this week, comparing it to what happened around the time of January 6th, a volume and a pitch to the sort of online rhetoric that we haven't seen in 18 months or maybe more, according to the head of the Defamation League. So that's from groups that track extremism. So we know there is that underneath the surface. And we also look at what happened yesterday with this standoff in Cincinnati, Ohio, where an armed suspect tried to breach the field office of the FBI there with some pretty serious weapons. So, yes, there is concern that law enforcement may be on the receiving end of some of this hate.
And so I'm curious, with the people that you rub elbows with in Washington, conservatives, law and order types, how do they feel about this?
Well, that's why I think it's going to be interesting this Sunday to talk to Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. He's a former FBI agent. He's also a Republican. I want to get his insight into how he understands this and how it is playing out. He's been fairly reserved in his judgment, unlike some of his Republican colleagues who have come out and maybe perhaps reflexively just said that this is, an overreach by law enforcement. The fact of the matter is we now know that not only did a federal judge approve for a search warrant to be issued and executed here this week, we know that going all the way back to the spring, another judge had also approved a subpoena for that information. We know that 15 boxes worth of documents were removed from the president's Florida residence and returned to the National Archives. So this isn't just coming out of nowhere. In other words, there is an important timeline of established facts that a court had to have reviewed and acted on.
And I'm also hearing comparisons, to Hillary's emails and Hunter Biden's laptop and all this stuff. Has there ever been a president who has essentially looted the White House of its documents and taken them home?
There have been high profile cases of U.S. officials abusing their access to classified information. A president of the United States? No. A commander in chief? No. This is, again, we use the term unprecedented far too often, but that is where we are, unprecedented territory. It was also extraordinary for an attorney general to come out and speak publicly about this case. And he said yesterday that he was doing so because the former president had already confirmed and detailed his version of events as to what happened in that Monday search of his property. So we are in an incredible moment once again here, but in terms terms of treatment of classified information, this also brings us back to that question of exactly how sensitive are these documents? Why would a warrant have to have been issued in the first place if the former president's counsel actually was cooperating, which is what they claim? Why was there something that immediately had to be acted on there? Those are the details that we hope to tease out in reporting in the coming days. I'm sure you have seen the Washington Post saying that the level of sensitivity was so incredibly high that it was also inclusive of nuclear material and documents related to nuclear weapons. So this is just the beginning of what appears to be a further developing story.
Right. And the next thing we're waiting for, of course, is for Trump to announce his candidacy for president.
Yes.
Anything more on that?
Well, that underscores the political backdrop to all of this. The former president is considered one of the front runners for the Republican Party nomination in 2024. What impact will there be from this? Certainly, you know, the former president has claimed again and again that all his legal woes are ultimately due to, you know, targeting of him as a political opponent. But once again, we come back to the facts here that the federal judges approved these things, that this wasn't just a political matter. But there's also the possibility that this backfires. You know, the president's supporters are former president's supporters often are very loyal. And as we have seen in terms of the level of rhetoric here and even the statements from Republican leaders that question law enforcement here, there seems to be a reflexive defense of him. So does this actually rally people to his side rather than hurt his political prospects? We don't know the answer yet.
It's all very strange for me to observe this because I remember the 70s and when my generation, liberals of my generation, also hated the FBI. We thought that they were sending provocateurs to our demonstrations. And now it's flipped completely. Now it's conservatives who don't trust them. It's crazy, Margaret.
We are in extraordinary times.
Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation, CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington. An evergreen playground.
On Fridays, our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us for All Over the Map, part of our commitment to public education and raising the level of historical knowledge for the residents of Seattle.
Pressure's on.
Yeah, I know. Today, Dateline Toledo, Washington, where this weekend it's time once again for the Mount St. Helens Bluegrass Festival.
Yeah, Toledo's in Lewis County. It's named for an old steamboat on the Cowlitz River. It's near where the Cowlitz Convention was held in 1851 when those angry settlers north of the Columbia organized a movement to split off Washington from what was then Oregon Territory. Now, the Mount St. Helens Bluegrass Festival, it's produced by the nonprofit Washington Bluegrass Association. It gets underway at noon today at Kemp Olson Memorial Park, where you can camp out if you want. The first one was held back in 1982, but this is only the 37th edition, still a big deal. Festival producer is a guy named General Cothran. General is his given name. He's from North Carolina. He came to Southwest Washington as a kid about 70 years ago. And General took time out a few days ago from fixing his golf cart, which is a critical tool for producing an outdoor music festival, as everyone knows,
right,
to tell me what makes bluegrass bluegrass.
It's just, you know, banjo, mandolin, guitar, a fiddle, and a bass. And you got good music. It's all acoustic.
You know, bluegrass is from the American South. It's traditional music that goes back at least a few centuries. Bill Monroe popularized it beginning in the late 30s on radio and then through records. Now, around here in the 1940s, because of World War II and other economic factors, a lot of Tar Heels, people from North Carolina, like General Cothran's parents, moved west and settled in the Puget Sound area and brought bluegrass with them. Now, Vivian Williams is 84 and a fiddler. She and her late husband, Phil, who played banjo, lived in Seattle. Around 1960, they started going to Tar Heel Hootenannies to learn and play bluegrass in and around the Skagit Valley.
Darrington was kind of the center of it because there was this couple that lived up there, and that's Fred and Alice McFalls. And Fred was a good banjo player and a really nice guy. And his wife was a good cook and very, very sweet, nice person, and they would just host these gatherings of musicians.
You know, Fred McFalls is a legend. I had never heard of him before. He moved to Darrington from North Carolina in the early 50s and worked in the timber industry. Fred and his wife Alice deserve a documentary. So do Vivian and Phil Williams, for that matter. They had a record label. They did so much to popularize that music and spread it around here. Now, here's a vintage recording of Fred.
Gotta go home, gotta go home, boy, gotta go home.
So, you know, Darrington had their Bluegrass Festival mid-July. Bellingham has theirs next month. But this weekend, the focus is in Toledo. Tickets are really cheap. There's barbecue on site by Boss Hogs over from Winlock, home of the Giant Egg. All these stories are connected, as people will note. And Sunday is Gospel Day. It starts around 9:30. Many of the same artists from Friday and Saturday, but with free admission. Because you can't charge admission for people to come and celebrate the gospel, right?
No, so, yeah,
anyway,
exactly right.
Down in Toledo, Mount St. Helens Bluegrass Festival.
They might pass the hat, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. And cash only. They don't have any way to take your credit card. So if you're headed to Toledo, bring a big wad of cash.
Okay. Yeah, have you done a report on the Big Egg?
I did. Yeah, we went way deep on the Big Egg not too long ago. I'm surprised you don't remember, Dave.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll look it up because all of his features are at mynorthwest.com. You can look them up anytime. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:49, Seattle's Morning News. And we have a date. The West Seattle Bridge is expected to reopen September 18th. However, there's a lot left to do, and there could be some hiccups. So, Chris, tell us what the situation is.
Okay, it's going to be kind of a mad dash to finish everything in time for that Sunday reopening. The list of to-do items is really long. SDOT's Heather Marks, who's in charge of this repair project, says there's always the possibility that something can come up.
We still have some concrete to pour for the overlay and to fix the holes in the deck. There are always last minute supply chain issues, last minute worker shortages, last minute, you know, the whole crew gets COVID.
So, you know, there's always some things that could get in the way. She's just kind of tempering everybody. Jeez. That unforeseen things happen on some of these projects. Of course, they have final carbon fiber wrapping to do, crack filling to do as well. And then comes the most important test of all of this. That's the load testing. Engineers need to make sure that the bridge can handle the weight of the cars, buses, and trucks. And Mark says there will be static and dynamic testing using fully loaded double dump trucks.
We're going to have a dump truck with a trailer loaded to a certain weight, and we're going to have several of them placed at strategic points on the bridge, and we're going to use that monitoring system that we installed way back when the bridge first closed to make sure that the bridge is responding appropriately to that static load.
Now, if all goes well with that test, Mark says those trucks will then be driven across the bridge.
We're going to run them over the bridge, right? We're going to drive them over the bridge and again watch that monitoring system to make sure that the bridge is responding to that load as we expect it to.
And that's the key. If the data doesn't look right or more testing is needed, Mark says that opening date will be pushed.
We would never open an unsafe bridge. That is absolutely true. The safety of the traveling public is much more important to us than the convenience of the traveling public, although that's clearly also important.
There has been a lot of criticism over the 2+ years that the bridge has been closed, mainly over how long it has taken to kind of get to this point. And just to reset the timeline a little bit, I mean, it took about 8 months for the city to figure out what was happening and why, and to make the decision on to whether replace the bridge or to repair it. There was time over that winter of 2020 into 2021 where engineers had to wait to see if the carbon fiber wrapping and the post-tensioning plan would work as a fix. And for public project, Mark says, this went blazing fast.
I am convinced that we could not have done it faster. Anyone who is involved in this project knows how much has gone into this, and anyone who is not involved does not know.
And when she looks back over the last 2 years, Mark's as proud as what the city's been able to accomplish.
It is regrettable that the bridge specs in the 80s were not what they should have been. But here we are. Instead of complaining about it, we just went ahead and did all the things we needed to do to fix it.
Mark says the city should be able to get several decades out of this new repaired bridge, although it will eventually have to be replaced.
Okay, so they're going to load up trucks to their capacity, park them on the bridge, and then there are like sensors that could sense any unnecessary motion or cracks?
Also in waiting and things like that. That's all built inside. Remember, the bridge is hollow.
Right.
The girders are hollow. So they built all these things inside. They're putting a permanent platform inside there to allow much better monitoring. And so they're going to be looking at whatever the load is during static and then dynamic testing to see if it's okay. And then if the numbers all work out, they'll be like, okay, it can handle trucks and buses and cars, and they'll open the gates.
And she referred to it briefly at the end there, but they now know why it began to crack?
Yeah, this all goes back to steel. The steel was not strong enough that they used
steel
in the original.
Yeah, so it wasn't the concrete.
No, the steel failed, and that led to the concrete cracking. And so that was basically bad steel.
And these are the cables?
Yeah, these are basically the cables that hold the bridge together that are inside the concrete.
Right.
Were not strong enough to handle what they, and let's not forget, they've added extra loads onto this thing by allowing trucks, putting bus lanes. I mean, originally it wasn't maybe designed to handle this kind of, and they kept adding to it. So, but the original smoking gun they've gone back to time after time is that it was the steel that failed, led to the cracking, and so
that steel's all been replaced now.
Well, no, what they've done is they've added 62 miles of new steel through the middle of the box girders, tied them to concrete, and then tightened them so tight that they pulled all three spans together.
That's even more weight, and they've calculated all that.
Yeah, that's what they've done. So they, again, the engineers are doing their thing, and yeah, we'll see how it goes on September 18th.
Who gets to drive that first truck?
I don't know. I know Felix and I were thinking about let's try to make it happen, and we can put a video together for Histority. For Histority, that's how history and
it's a good word.
Whatever the other words.
Let's do Seattle's Morning News on the road. We could do the show from the West Seattle Bridge.
From the center of the bridge.
I was thinking of posterity and history. You put those two words together.
Posterity.
That's what it is. But no, by the way, they're not announcing the time of when they're opening the bridge just for that reason. They don't want chaos of people like, I was the first person over the bridge and stuff like that. So,
King County Executive Dow Constantine has announced a coalition to tackle the behavioral health crisis. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott.
County Executive Dale Constantine says between the effects of the pandemic and the never-ending affordable housing crisis and more, the overlapping crises have pushed the already weak behavioral health care system to the breaking point.
At precisely the moment when we need more mental health and substance use resources than ever, we lack places for people to go, we face dwindling numbers of mental health beds, and we are confronted with a strained workforce, and we suffer limited options for people in the community to get the care they need when they need it.
The reality in King County?
If you were someone who needed immediate care in a mental health or substance use crisis, there is not a single behavioral health walk-in care facility in King County. The only options are overburdened emergency rooms or very often jail. We cannot accept having the county jail as the main place for people to get behavioral health care. And right now, it is a fact that the jail across the street is the second largest behavioral health facility in the state of Washington.
On top of that,
but the problem's not just limited to our ability to respond during a crisis. Over the last 4 years, we have lost one-third of our mental health long-term residential beds in King County, one-third. And it would have been more but for our intervention. And more facilities are potentially closing their doors in the months ahead. We are losing mental health capacity quickly at a time when we need more of it.
That's why Constantine has formed this coalition, meant to include city, county, and state leaders, as well as behavioral health workers and others, to work together on giving the system an upgrade.
This coalition today is ready to act because mental health is a critical component of care on which we all depend. Having a functioning society must include behavioral health care. That is why we must respond with action. So all of us are here to work together over the next few weeks, and we're going to meet with crisis responders and providers and elected leaders and business and community organizations to form a robust policy proposal to address this crisis with the urgency and on the scale that is needed to meet the levels of care required today and to serve our community tomorrow.
Constantine says they know from the onset that this plan will focus in three main areas.
Building a regional network of care centers so individuals and families and first responders can get the help they need 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Turning the tide on this loss of residential care I described, and building the capacity the community needs, and developing the workforce, the staff these services need to operate sustainably for patients and providers.
Democratic State Representative Nicole Macri says the state legislature has made some historic investment in the last couple of years. But she also noted,
achieving this, though, will require hard work and close collaboration. We will need our legislators, our state agencies, our community behavioral health providers, local government leaders, and the workers themselves who are providing this care to do this. It will require sustained investment and a willingness to do things in a new way.
The idea is for this group to work together over the next several weeks and come up with a wide-ranging plan that can be proposed to the King County Council alongside Constantine's budget in a few weeks. They also didn't get very specific on exactly what the plan might look like, but some of the things they're looking at include things that have been working in other states. County Human Services Director Leo Floor explained what some of the possibilities might be.
Example, so a crisis care center has to be 24/7 accessible. It has to have walk-in urgent care for behavioral health on site. A law enforcement officer, a community member, a person themselves have to be able to enter them in the moment of crisis. The second piece that we're taking a look at is we need peer living rooms, and you might hear them also called peer 23-hour living rooms, with the ability for a person who, in their moment of highest escalation, might actually look like a person we need to arrest or to involuntarily commit, but with just an hour of time with a peer and a chance to cool down, can actually be in a much different state, and then we don't have to use a jail.
Hannah, I may be hallucinating, but didn't I hear this exact same speech 10 years ago, or was it 20 years ago?
I think it was, well, I know it was 10 years ago for sure, probably 20 as well. I think this is the
I guess I'm saying is what's changed. I have heard this speech a number of times. And
right.
And it's exactly the same. We need this, we need this, we need this. And now we still need this and this and this. Plus, Harborview is now at capacity. So who is responsible for providing all this? Who's the point
person? Well, that's just it. This particular issue is the coalition formed by Dow Constantine that will be part of his go up, like I said, in his proposed budget is the idea. But he also made clear yesterday, you know, whatever, there's not a lot of clarity on what kind of funding this might require, but he said for sure that it can't be just the county. So this reminded me a lot of when he and former mayor Jenny Durkin made the big announcement about the upcoming regional homelessness authority. That was several years ago.
Yeah.
And it was a big announcement, groundbreaking, and it was a plan to make a plan, basically. And that's just basically coming online now. Of course, we had the pandemic in the middle, but that's kind of what this reminded me of. I will say the mental health system, the behavioral health system, so substance abuse and mental health in our state, in our county, in our country, for that matter, is a huge lift, and it takes everyone to be working together. So I like what I'm seeing here on that front. The one thing that I think that they absolutely have to get that wasn't talked about a lot yesterday is you've got to get some buy-in from the federal government. That is what's missing. That is the missing component. There's not enough investment coming from that. Hopefully there's some aspect there that can be done. And we need, I know that the legislature has made historic investments in behavioral health the last two sessions. It's not good enough. They need to make more. So what that funding is going to come from, we'll have to see. I'm excited that they are at least having a sense of urgency about this. I liked all of the different people that they had there yesterday about this. And I want to point out, this is building on the 988 system that we just launched. Dave, mm-hmm. We've done a couple of stories on that. And the things you heard Leo Floor talking about there at the end, the crisis 24/7 centers and those peer 23 living room things, those are the same rooms and facilities that Representative Tina Orwell had told me about that they have in their vision for 988. So same kind of deal. This is building on that. This is kind of specific to the county, but they hope to get this all statewide.
But there's still no place where if I'm walking downtown, I hear somebody who is howling at the moon or screaming at passersby, where a compassionate team of trained professionals can take them to a walk-in center and provide treatment or at least some kind of timeout.
No, there are no walk-in. You heard him say it. There's no walk-in centers. No place. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. Representative Macri said there's some kind of regulatory and statutory things that need to be fixed. The bottom line is they don't have any of those facilities. Those facilities are generally capped at 16 beds for Medicaid pay, right? That's a whole nother thing. And then also they don't have the workforce. That's the other big part of this. We heard from some of the behavioral health workforce yesterday that are still on the workforce, and they can't even afford to pay their rent. They don't get paid enough. And they're burned out. There's so much need and not enough support. So they're leaving this profession. So just like with the police, we have to figure out how to build up this workforce at the same time, and that's going to mean more investment for better pay.
Yep. People who do that kind of work, want to be financially secure. And
as well they should be.
I do not blame them. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Yesterday, we helped celebrate the retirement of a U.S. Postal Service worker who's been on the job 70 years and counting. Today, another big milestone, nearly six decades for this crossing guard, who's more like royalty. For the story, we head to CBS News in Philadelphia.
Arriving by limo to a big round of applause, Claire Bowman greeted students, staff, and family outside Horace Mann Elementary School in Cherry Hill Monday. It was a break from her usual job as the school crossing guard, which she's been doing every day since 1965.
It's just awesome. I mean, they've done so many things for me here. It's such a great school.
The Queen of Walt Whitman Boulevard, as she's known by, says her love of children is what kept her coming back to work for decades.
I love the kids. I mean, I've always, you know, they're foremost in my mind, getting them safely across the street.
And Bowman's family points out she rarely missed a day of work.
I call her the Energizer Bunny Rabbit. She's constantly moving. She does more than me. And I'm planning on retiring in November. And I said, Mom, you have to retire before I do, because if you don't, I can't retire.
She just like dials it down like it's nothing, which it's a big deal. I'm like, you kind of give me a little bit of a worry that I have to work till I'm 94.
Last week, the school threw a parade for Bowman's retirement, and the celebration continued with Monday's farewell.
So our last cheer for Ms. Bowman.
Steve Linville is one of Bowman's first students.
Glad to be in part of it, tell you the truth. You know, it's 53 years I've known the lady. Great lady.
And Bowman's dedication to the job will be remembered with this brick. It's engraved with her name and was made in her honor after 25 years on the job.
I hope that the person that takes my place likes it as much as I did. I loved the school. I loved everybody in it. It's been a good 57 years.
I can't wait to celebrate your 60th work anniversary, Dave. It's going to be a good celebration when you hit 60 years.
Yes.
Because you're never leaving.
That will be interesting.
Can I get you on the record?
No. 7:49, and now from the Gene Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock right here. G. Scott, let's see what we can throw at you this morning. We have Marshawn Lynch's arrest and Earl Thomas's house struck by lightning. That seems like piling on.
Yeah, it was a rough day for former Seahawks, at least for Earl Thomas yesterday, and just in the news. Let's just cover where Earl Thomas, that situation. We don't know much other than lightning struck his house and then it was on fire. And so there has been little comment as to that. I'm sure that is an ongoing thing. So we'll find out more. And, you know, sometimes some of the news that we've been hearing about Earl Thomas since he has since left the game hasn't always been so favorable, you know, from the situation that happened where his now ex-wife, when she showed up to the scene where he was allegedly in a hotel room with his brother and another woman, that happened. That was one thing. And then the other thing, when you had the restraining order that was put on him. So it's not a lot of favorable news. As to Marshawn, Harvey Dent in Batman said, "You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain." And in the case of Marshawn, he's a grown man, 36 years old. He should know better. This is his second time when in the case of alleged DUI. And in this case right here, you could see, you see photos of the vehicle. The vehicle was all messed up. The tire was off the rim.
Oh, so he crashed too. It wasn't just being pulled over for driving erratically, but
well,
he crashed?
Well, technically, when he showed up on the scene, he was already parked.
Oh.
According to what the video
is. The story says he was asleep.
He was asleep.
Yeah.
And so they ask him to, you know, they're talking to him and they ask him to get out of the vehicle and he didn't want to get out of the vehicle. and they kept asking him to get out of the vehicle. He did not want to get out of the vehicle. And finally, they went to go grab him out of the vehicle. And unfortunately, you see the video of them dragging him out of the video. I mean, out of the vehicle. And
did he fight back?
I mean, he didn't make it easy, you know?
It worries me.
It worries me, too, because when I was talking to some people yesterday, and we already know that we have situations in this country where we see where these exchanges can go bad. And my father used to always tell me, you want to be right or do you want to go home? And this whole, like this idea, and I want any young women and men to be listening. Look, stop with this whole, like if these cops pull you over and you and they want you to do something, they want to handcuff you. Would you please stop with the whole resisting and restraint and quit moving? Because if it goes bad, sure. Yeah, we could talk about it and we can get on the radio. We could talk about these things. But if you're no longer here, does it even matter? So in this case, I just think that what Marshawn did is like, look, it's a bad example. Period. Get out of the car. Do what they say. And so this whole idea of because it's authority or because it's the police telling you to do something and somebody says, well, maybe he's too drunk. I don't know if he's drunk or not. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the blood test. I didn't see the BAC levels or anything like that. But I do know what I saw on the video.
Has he found a life after football?
Sure. Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Super popular. Super name.
Yeah.
Has all of this stuff going on. All of these things going on. And then for something like this to have people say, see, I told you the only reason why he got success is because of football. Yeah. So I just want to say that it was hard to watch, Colleen. It was very hard to watch. And I was disappointed seeing it.
He's got to take care of his mentals, take care of his chickens, right? Take his own advice.
And take it, and that is an example of not taking care of your mentals and chicken in that video.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio.
Happy
Thanks,
Friday, guys.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The House of Representatives has passed an assault weapons ban. We've talked about that, and we wanted to get the viewpoint of Larry Keen, who is Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And I guess it's safe to say that you are against this, correct?
Oh, very much so, because it is both unconstitutional under the Second Amendment and because we know from the prior ban that was in place for 10 years, it will do nothing to make our communities safer. So for those reasons, we are very strongly opposed to this legislation.
Okay, so if this wouldn't work, if you had your way, what would you propose to make massacres with semi-automatic rifles less likely?
Well, I think mass shootings with any firearm is abhorrent. It is certainly not something members of the firearm industry want to see. But we believe that there is common ground that can be found on issues that will make our communities safer. In fact, the industry is leading the effort through what we call Real Solutions for Safer Communities. And we're doing things like ensuring that the background check system that every person who buys a gun from a licensed dealer has to go through a background check to ensure that that system works as designed and intended, and making sure that the records on people who are not allowed by law to purchase firearms are in that system.
What and about then the young men who are too young to have a record or are juveniles and those juvenile records cannot be transferred to the federal system, right? 19 kids killed by an AR-15. That shooter did not have a record that could have prevented him from obtaining that gun.
The Constitution doesn't allow categorical bans, particularly or specifically of commonly owned firearms. And the modern sporting rifle, what you refer to as the AR-15, is the most popular rifle being sold in the United States today. There are over 25 million of them commonly owned for lawful purposes by millions of Americans and not being used to commit crime. So you can't ban the firearm.
You actually can. But that's not to say, you just have to choose to.
Well, we don't believe the Constitution, particularly after
You could make it less commonly owned. See, if you controlled the advertising, maybe not as many people would buy them, and then they would no longer be commonly owned, and then they wouldn't qualify as a commonly owned firearm.
And popular.
Well, I think that's twisting the Second Amendment into a pretzel. Americans have a right to own commonly owned firearms.
We also
this
have a right
to clearly
live.
They're commonly owned. That's a fact. You can't ban them. But let's talk about where we can agree. So you talk about, for example, juveniles. That's why Congress just passed, as part of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, expanding background checks involving young adults 18 to 21 to check to make sure that there's no record that the state has that's not in the federal system that would indicate that while they were a juvenile, they became a prohibited person.
What about being proactive? Suppose the gun shop dealers, just on their own without, you know, having to pass a law, took it upon themselves to look into the social media feeds of people who purchase guns. I know that no gun shop wants to see one of its guns misused. So why wouldn't they want to go the extra length to make sure they're not selling to a stranger? Get to know somebody before you empower them, especially with one of these very powerful weapons.
I don't think it's right to put that burden on the dealer to somehow.
I wouldn't force
him.
I would just
agency.
Suggest that that'd be a good way to prevent one of your guns from ending up, you know, killing a bunch of kids and, you know, having to go through
all
the grief of that.
Nobody wants that, and to suggest that anybody in the industry wants, obviously nobody in America wants to see that happen.
But it's happening, so it has to fall on the shoulders of somebody to take responsibility, and nobody's taking responsibility.
I would start with the family. Why did the father in Highland Park, knowing what he knew about his son, sign the documents that allowed him to get a firearms owner ID card from the state police? Why did the Highland Park police not tell the Illinois State Police the issues involving this individual? Why did the Uvalde law enforcement stand in the hallway for over an hour instead of going into the room and stopping what was occurring?
And you know what? We'd have none of these questions if that boy could not have gotten his hands on that AR-15.
But he was an adult. He was legally allowed to purchase that firearm.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Well, that's you can have it, but we can agree to disagree. But he is an adult. He's fully vested
in his
constitutional
rights. How are you defending the Uvalde shooter right now?
How are you accusing me of defending him?
Because you just said he was legally able to. You are defending him. I'm saying this monster killed 19 children, and you're saying he legally obtained the gun, as if that's a good enough excuse to excuse the lives of these 19 children.
First of all, that's an offensive comment to suggest that I am defending the shooter in Uvalde. I'm simply pointing out that he passed a background check because nobody in the community or nobody in his family or none of his friends or the schools did anything to address the serious mental health issues involving that young man.
Well, I'd like to figure out how to prevent something like that. So given that we know that in these families, for whatever, I don't know what causes their dysfunction, you have a parent who would, you know, indulge a kid like this. How do we defend ourselves against that? And what I'm saying is, since this kid had posted something nicknaming himself school shooter, let's put someone in charge of discovering that. And if the parents aren't going to do it, and if law enforcement isn't going to do it for whatever reason, then unfortunately reality says it's the dealer. It's up to the dealer. He's the one who's going to sell the weapon that's going to be used in this horrible thing. Why wouldn't he voluntarily want to take on, and all dealers want to voluntarily take on the responsibility of making absolutely sure that when somebody walks in the shop, they don't have plans to shoot up a school? Why wouldn't they voluntarily? I mean, it's easy to search social media these days, get complete ID from this kid, demand to know where his social media feeds are, and examine them before giving him this powerful weapon.
So you're asking the dealer to become a mental health professional.
I am, yes. What's wrong with that?
That because they're not trained in that. That's not their profession.
Maybe they need to be,
I would suggest the school ought to be checking the social media of individuals, particularly someone like this, where they knew had issues.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, it's the dealer who is giving them the weapons, giving them the tool. The school isn't selling guns.
And you're right. The school has this obligation. And you're absolutely right. The cops were cowards. And we know all that. But here we're trying to work together to prevent this. And I'm telling you that the last step that these kids take before they open fire, actually any crook, is they go to the gun shop. They know they haven't got a record. They know they're going to get the weapon. And they know that the gun dealer is not going to really give them much of an interrogation. And
they conduct a criminal background check through the FBI.
But we know that doesn't work. You told me it doesn't work.
Person. And that's a background check system that the industry supports. And it was actually the industry that conceived of the point of purchase background check system long before the Brady Act.
I know, but you're telling me it doesn't work.
I think dealers are very conscientious about who they sell firearms to, reject sales, deny sales all the time. I do think there are things that can be done. I do think there is common ground, and the industry is working towards real solutions that still respect the Constitution. And I think that when we have overheated rhetoric, it's not conducive to having a conversation towards finding common ground, like we saw with the Fix-NICS Act and like provisions we saw within the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, like additional funds for school security, additional funds for mental health. We think that's very, very important. So we do think there's common ground.
Larry Keen is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Larry, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Thanks.
All right. And just full disclosure, that was boiled down from like a half-hour interview. Are we going to post the whole thing? I hope we can.
On the Ross Files podcast, you want that whole thing on there?
Yes, I do. Yes, sure. I do. I mean, he makes it sound like it's crazy to expect gun dealers to do all this research.
Right?
But when you think about turning over a really powerful weapon to somebody,
yeah.
The idea that you wouldn't even know them or know their skill level or even sit down and say, hey, what do you want this for? This is a pretty powerful weapon. Just seems... I would think that the dealers would want to just protect themselves from that. And when you talk to the ATF, they point out that most dealers, like he said, are responsible. They obviously don't want their weapons used in this way.
It's 5% of dealers in America that account for 90% of crime weapons.
Yeah. So at least ask those 5%, so what's going on there? And could we help you make sure that your guns aren't misused in this way?
And we looked into that data, too, from somebody we interviewed earlier this week and found that there are dealerships here in Washington. One in particular had 19 violations, including failure to report stolen merchandise, failure to report inventory that mysteriously went missing. I mean, this person we spoke to wanted the responsibility to be on everyone except for those who are responsible for manufacturing, distributing, and selling firearms. And that's frustrating because it doesn't put the onus on those who have the most stake in the game.
And it's not to say don't make sure the cops are trained or don't make sure that the schools are watching. I'm just saying everybody involved in the process needs to do that. And it seems like it's the weak link is the dealers. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.